My guest William Weld is temporarily out of politics, but he's carefully watching what's happening in the impeachment debate. Weld is a former federal prosecutor. He worked on the Nixon impeachment hearing and the Iran-Contra investigation. He served as the governor of Massachusetts from 1991 to 97, and then made what's been described as one of the most abrupt, astonishing U-turns in recent political history. He challenged the Democratic incumbent John Kerry for a seat in the U.S. Senate and lost. Soon after, President Clinton nominated Weld to serve as ambassador to Mexico. Weld resigned from his position as governor to pursue this new position, but after strong opposition led by Jesse Helms, Weld withdrew his nomination. Now Weld is in private practice. He's written a new political novel called Mackerel by Moonlight. It's about a former federal prosecutor who's elected district attorney in Boston, then has his eye on a Senate seat. Here's a short reading that takes place just after he's become the DA, defeating the incumbent. He's asking his outgoing predecessor for advice.
I had gone to Marty Gross in early December and said I knew he had an administrative first assistant, and I knew he had a legal guy, and I knew he had a press guy. But what I wanted to know was, who was the real guy? Who does your less desirable laundry? Who makes it happen when skies are cloudy and gray, I asked. Gross told me it was this retired Sergeant Potts from the PD who handled the administrative-cum-political stuff and basically covered his flank and rear. Gross urged me to keep him. When you're riding into Dodge City, you don't want to ride in alone, he advised me. You want somebody covering your backside, and you may have to be riding back-to-back to keep an eye on all the Indians. Much obliged, Mr. District Attorney. I will keep this well in mind, I had said.
How does your main character's experiences in politics compare to yours?
Well, most of the main characters in this book are composites of myself, my wife, my press secretaries, my campaign managers, and my political opponents. Certainly much of what Terry learns here is stuff that I learned, and much of his opening agenda was my opening agenda, namely depoliticize the prosecutor's office. But he does some bad stuff here, stuff I'm happy to say I never was obliged to do during my brief career.
Such as?
Well, I'm not going to give away the ending, but let's say not just that mistakes were made, but crimes happened.
William Weld, why did you write a novel?
A novel as opposed to a kiss and tell, you can be much more vicious in fiction. You can tell more in fiction. It's really no holds barred because all the names have been changed to protect the guilty.
Well, you know, now that you've written a novel, I feel I can ask you this. A lot of people are saying that the Bill Clinton Kenneth Starr story reads more like a novel than reality. What do you think?
Nah, nobody would believe it. It wouldn't sell 500 copies.
If it was a novel?
Right.
The House Judiciary Committee vote to proceed with impeachment hearings, that vote was strictly along party lines. I wonder what that says to you.
Well, I don't think the tawdry office affair, even with lying on top of it, is the stuff of impeachment and removal. I mean, many years ago, in 1973-4, I worked on the House Judiciary Committee on the Nixon impeachment hearings. Indeed, there was a fellow worker, a co-worker named Hillary Rodham, and our first assignment, and she and I were two of the first people hired, was to write a memorandum defining what constitutes grounds for impeachment of a president. And, you know, our conclusion was it doesn't have to be a crime. After all, what if the president moved to a foreign country and took up a life of pleasure? That may not be a crime, but he has to be subject to being removed for that. On the other hand, it does have to have something to do with his ability to exercise the duties of his office. So, you know, I think there's a real strong case to be made for the proposition that this is not what the framers had in mind as the basis for removal by the Senate. In that sense, I'm somewhat surprised that the vote was as party line as it was. I would have thought the issue would have been thought to be somewhat more doubtful than that.
I want to get back to your role on the impeachment inquiry for President Nixon, but since the vote was so along party lines, I wonder what it's like for you to be perceived as a Republican who often breaks with the party, someone whose views don't always go along with what's considered traditional Republican views, such as your support of gay rights, abortion.
Well, you know, I break with everybody all the time. Even in this current situation involving President Clinton, my views are acceptable to virtually nobody. I think it's not impeachable and removable. I think the president should not be prosecuted for perjury or anything else because nobody else would be. And I was a federal prosecutor for 7 years and the head of the criminal division in Washington, and I can tell you nobody would be prosecuted federally for having an extramarital affair and then lying to cover it up. As a matter of fact, until last year, the law was that you could not be prosecuted for perjury simply for denying wrongdoing. The Supreme Court changed that rule last year, but I think they would have done well to leave a carve-out for personal conduct. They didn't, but I think that doctrine in the law still suggests that this is not a cognizable federal criminal case. On the other hand, it does seem to me that it would not be amiss for the president to consider from time to time whether his effectiveness has been very much corroded and undermined, whether people are no longer taking him seriously, whether when he says, please send troops to Kosovo or please support the IMF or even please come to the state dinner in the East Room, are people saying, yes, Mr. President, and looking at him and thinking only about Monica Lewinsky and thinking that they've been invited to the White House just to be part of the act, to pretend that there's not an elephant standing over in the corner of the room. If he came to the conclusion that that was true, then I think he might pardonably consider the early retirement option.
What's it been like for you over the years to have some strong opinions that differ from the majority of that just about everybody in the Republican Party?
Well, I don't think any individual one of my opinions differs from just about everybody in the party. Maybe the combination is a little unusual, although I think in my generation, the baby boomer generation, it's not that unusual. In a nutshell, my political philosophy is anti-government, pro-individual. In the economic area, that makes me a conservative because I'm in favor of tax cuts. My motto is there's no such thing as government money. There's only taxpayers' money. I was pretty conservative on reforming welfare and on tough sentences in the crime area. On the other hand, you get to other so-called social issues, such as abortion and gay rights. Again, I'm anti-government and pro-individual, which means I want the government not only out of your pocketbook, but also out of your bedroom. To me, that's consistent, and I think the right wing of the Republican Party is the one that's guilty of an inconsistency in suddenly wanting the government to solve all the problems when it reaches issues pertaining to human sexuality. To me, that's a disconnect.
What I think what a lot of politicians fear is that if they support gay rights policies, that they'll get the vote of gay people, but they'll lose a lot of votes in return, and that it's going to be more in the negative numbers finally when the results are tallied. How did that do for you? Do you feel like you won more or lost more votes in the long
run? Oh, no.
Run?
Clearly you lose more. And, you know, my political staff was well aware every time I took an initiative in the gay rights area that the polls were 10 to 90 against whatever we were going to do, whether it was just, you know, elementary fairness things like letting gay people have rights of visitation in hospitals or, you know, visit children in schools, stuff that you needed an executive order to be able to do, visit somebody, you know, some lifelong partner who's dying in a hospital. I mean, to me, that was not a very difficult decision to make. And I'm amazed that it seems to be as difficult as it does for just elementary fairness to be extended to gays and lesbians. And you know, it needn't be pecuniary advantage. I mean, I'm not even talking about collecting under life insurance policies. I'm just talking about treating them with dignity. In answer to your political question, gay and lesbian issues poll very badly. My sense is that neither party is ready for those issues at the national level.
My guest is William Weld, former governor of Massachusetts. He's written a new political novel called Mackerel by Moonlight. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is William Weld, the former governor of Massachusetts and a former federal prosecutor. He's written a political novel called Mackerel by Moonlight. Now, I want to get back to the work that you did when you were associate minority counsel for the House Judiciary Committee Nixon impeachment inquiry. Now, you say that you and Hillary Rodham, who were both working together at the time were given the task of writing grounds for impeachment. At what point in the process were you asked to write that?
Very early on. Hillary Rodham and I were the third and fourth people hired, I believe, in December of 1973 for the staff. And I shall never forget my first Friday there, John Doerr, who was the chief counsel, called me and Hillary Rodham into his office and said, I'd like to have a definition of the grounds for impeachment. Anytime Tuesday would be fine. So we looked in the wrong place. We looked in the law books. I think the right place to look for a definition of what's grounds for impeachment historically would be in the newspapers of the day, so you could find out not only the precise who struck John of the conduct in question, but what the political backdrop was in terms of the temper of the times. But suffice it to say that after many more lawyers than Miss Rodham and myself had looked at this for many more days than the span between a Friday and a Tuesday, they concluded that at one level, the definition of impeachable conduct that had been offered by Congressman Gerry Ford, namely whatever a majority of the House and two-thirds of the Senate says it is, at one level, that was a, quote, terse but profound definition, close quote. I think that's a little fast because that implies that you can skip the normative, the prescriptive element of the analysis, namely should a majority of the House or should two-thirds of the Senate say that this conduct constitutes grounds for impeachment or removal. I don't think you can get away from that. So I think you still have to hearken back to the legal backdrop, the English precedents, the American precedents, what constitutes high crimes and misdemeanors.
To what extent do you think that the guidelines that you and your colleagues came up with in the 70s could apply today?
Oh, I think they can apply. I mean, they were quite general. We pointed out that the conduct that's grounds for impeachment and removal need not be a crime. We pointed out that it has to have some connection with the president's discharge of the duties of his office. It can't be purely personal self-regarding conduct. I think both of those principles apply today.
I'm wondering what things you would most like to ask Ken Starr now about his investigation, if you were able to ask him directly.
Well, I'm in a small minority of people who have been senior Justice Department officials in Washington in that I think we should keep the independent counsel statute. I think the danger of corrosion of the criminal justice function of the government is so great that you have to put up with the relative unfairness of that statute towards the people who were covered by it. The way it works is that there's a small but defined class of federal officials that are covered by the statute that, you know, if they so much as look sideways at somebody, if there's the slightest credible allegation that they may have done something wrong, bingo, you get a special prosecutor, independent counsel, as it's now called, appointed to look into them. Well, that's much more of a hair trigger standard than the average citizen would undergo. To compensate for it, the statute says, but you got to finish the investigation in 60 or 90 days, and then fish or cut bait and determine whether there's something really substantial here to go further.
So I'm wondering if you have any questions about the way Kenneth Starr conducted his investigation. If you think he overstepped his powers, if you have any questions about how he first found out about the Monica Lewinsky story and if he could pursue it.
I don't know the facts of how he first came into possession of that. My impression reading the papers is that he was approached by Linda Tripp, who said, I have these tapes. One of the unfortunate things about the independent counsel statute is that the independent counsel's deliberations and decisions are not conducted with the same degree of secrecy as attends a normal grand jury proceeding. The wonderful thing about being a U.S. attorney, a federal prosecutor, is that you essentially preside over a secret establishment. You don't have people second-guessing you every 30 days or every 10 days saying, how come you haven't indicted so-and-so for such-and-such? Because people generally don't know that you have a grand jury sitting to review so-and-so or such-and-such. When someone is appointed a special prosecutor on page one of every newspaper in the country and everyone knows exactly who they're looking at and what they're looking at them for, that person would be subject to enormous second-guessing if he or she said, well, I'm not even going to go down that alley. So this is not politically correct to say, but I'm not sure that Ken Starr really had the luxury that a normal prosecutor might have had of saying, oh, no, wait a minute, This is about private sexual conduct. We're not going to ask any questions here. And I think there was enough of a suggestion of a possibility of obstruction of justice so that if I'd been his lawyer, I probably would not have advised him to say, no way are we going to even look at this.
Now, you're out of politics for the moment. You resigned from your position as governor of Massachusetts in order to pursue your nomination to the position of ambassador to Mexico. This was a President Clinton nomination. Then when you, under pressure, withdrew your nomination, you were kind of out of politics for a while. Do you wish you were back? Are you anxious to get back in?
No, I've taken a vow of non-poverty for 5 years, mirroring the number of children of college age that my wife and I have. No, I'm very happy to take a hiatus here. I'm still, you know, friendly with the people who are thinking of running in 2000, and I enjoy hearing their perspective. But I'm trying to keep my nose to the grindstone of business and occasionally produce a work of fiction to keep the mind alive.
William Weld, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry. Enjoyed it.
William Weld is the former governor of Massachusetts. He's written a political novel called Mackerel by Moonlight.